It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about whether or not we still need car dealerships in today's economy.
But first, we'll talk about the employment landscape for teachers since Act 10 passed in Wisconsin.
Now, this was reported in the Oshkosh Northwestern Media. The Wisconsin Education Association Council, or WEAC, and the Wisconsin Association of School Boards say school districts are letting more teachers go since Act 10 became law. Act 10, that was part of the budget bill back in 2011 that spurred protests, those huge protests at the state capitol that dramatically reduced collective bargaining rights for a lot of public sector unions, including teachers in Wisconsin.
Here to talk about this story is Randall Garshinsky, an attorney with the Wisconsin Education Association Council, or WEAC. Randall, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you, Cynthia.
So as I understand it, there's no formal tracking of how many people have been let go or have been fired from their teaching jobs. So how has WEAC determined how many have been let go?
Well, we don't have an exact number at this point in time that I can give you, but the members will be confronted with a termination or non-renewal, and they work with their regional Uniserv directors to deal with the problem, and then that is very often referred to the legal division if something can be done in regard to a hearing or a negotiation of an exit agreement or resignation in lieu of termination or non-renewal. And those instances are up substantially in terms of our case workload here at WEAC.
This might be a technical question, but it might also be very important to distinguish. So the headlines have been saying that more teachers are fired. Is it an actual firing as we understand what firings to be, or is it just a matter of contract renewal and non-renewal?
It's really more contract renewal and non-renewal, and I think that speaks to the fact that this isn't really getting rid of bad teachers for bad acts. There's always been historically a difference between terminating somebody for doing something very outrageous and then non-renewing a teacher. If you non-renew a teacher, there's a window of time within the spring that the teacher is entitled to notice they're not going to be renewed for the next year, and they can go through a procedure of having a private conference with the board and discussing that non-renewal. But they're teaching throughout the remainder of the year until that contract is over. So historically, the non-renewals have been for relatively minor things, possibly even layoffs for the coming season, not true firings or terminations. Now we're not seeing really an increase in terminations, but the school boards are using more and more the non-renewal process to eliminate teachers who would never have been subject to termination under a just cause standard that we used to have under the collective bargaining agreements or even within the non-renewal process itself. So you're finding a increase in that kind of termination of contracts, not the firing in a traditional sense. You do something wrong, your employer comes over, points a finger at you like Donald Trump does and declares you're fired. It's a different process that's going on, but it's being used more and more in my opinion and a lot of people's opinions because there is no more just cause standard. They don't have to prove up a reason. They can simply non-renew the contract.
Are the standards well known and understood, though? Is a teacher, informed about whether or not they are meeting those standards before they receive the non-renewal?
Well, there are no standards for non-renewal. They don't even, under the statute, even have to give you a reason for the non-renewal. You can when they give you that notice of non-renewal, they don't even have to tell you why. And then you can ask for a private conference to discuss what it is. But then that reason is simply whatever reason they come up with under the current post-Act 10 law. They do not have to give a just cause type of reason for you having done something wrong, not performed your job functions or duties, or having done something else that would be a dismissible offense.
Is there any recourse?
Very little, and that's part of the problem with Post-Act 10. There used to be recourse where the employees could grieve the termination or non-renewal, and then there would be a hearing in front of a neutral hearing board, the WERC, the Wisconsin Employment Relations Commission. And through that process, both sides would present their case to a neutral arbitrator, and the matter would be heard and resolved. Now, the perception is the prosecutor, judge, and jury are all the same, because the school district brings the non-renewal. You can have a conference with the school board, which is the school district. You can go to an independent hearing officer, but the independent hearing officers are by and large management-oriented attorneys or human resource people from other districts, and then the final appeal is to the board itself again. So the perception is that this is not much of a really, truly due process, a fair due process and fair hearing, because the same people that initiated the complaint against you and approved the initial non-renewal or termination are the ones who hear the final appeal. It creates an incredible perception of unfairness. I know there are a lot of people out there in school districts who are trying to be fair. I'm not saying that they're intentionally being unfair, but the process itself is set up so that it is, at the very least, perceived as prejudiced or biased, and very often, in fact, functions that way. And it's causing therefore, a lot of teachers who are presented with non-renewal for a very amorphous or arbitrary reason to then negotiate a resignation instead of going through this process and having on their record a non-renewal or what amounts to a firing in common parlance. Mm.
Aren't there federal laws in place to protect teachers and other employees from unfair dismissals like this?
Very limited. Mm. We have Act 10, which dismantled 50 to 60 years of collective bargaining and took away a tremendously fair and equitable vehicle for resolving disputes, that is, having both sides go in front of a neutral, the WERC Commission, and their arbitrators, took that away. And that was decades and decades of history of being able to resolve labor disputes in a timely, efficient, and manner that was perceived by both sides as fair and unbiased.
I'm wondering if you have a sense of the mood among teachers right now. Are they a bit fearful, a bit less secure about their employment right now?
They're a mixture of emotions. There's resentfulness at having their rights taken away by Act 10. There's fearfulness that they have no longer even the basic rudimentary protections of the concept of just cause when they're charged with something or being dismissed. And they're seeing many of their fellow professionals being subjected to non-renewal situations that would have never risen to the level of just cause under the prior collective bargaining agreements or with that standard now being dismissed. And there's a very much a feeling of concern and a feeling of unfairness and a feeling that the playing field is tilted very much against them by this what Act 10 has done to this whole process.
Well, on the other hand, supporters of Act 10 would say that these changes provide more flexibility and the ability to maybe put more effective teachers in the schools. What do you say to that?
I say they're feeding a myth and they're feeding on some very untrue facts. With just cause was no magical panacea that or shield for ineffective or bad teachers. It's predicated on some basic fundamental rights of knowing what our offense is, having a fair hearing, and ultimately having the punishment fit the crime, having had to have done something that truly merits termination or the economic death penalty, if you would have it. Now, without that, there are no standards to restrain boards or administrators. They could always get rid of a truly bad or ineffective teacher if they simply went through the process of building their case, documenting the fact that this teacher is ineffective, warning them that they are ineffective, and if they don't change, there's going to be some penalties, and then finally the evaluation and the hearing and termination for not meeting the standards of effectiveness. This has always been there. Good administrators, effective administrators, have never had any problem getting rid of truly bad or ineffective teachers. This is just a huge red herring that's been thrown out there by people who I believe are truly in opposition of the whole idea or concept of a teacher's union or association to protect their rights.
Well, Randall, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Randall Garshinsky, an attorney with WEAC. We'll get another perspective on this story tomorrow.
Next, we'll talk about whether or not we still need car dealerships. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
If you're in the market for a brand new car, that means a trip to the dealership, no matter whether you're overwhelmed by the experience or can't wait to check out the shiny cars in the showroom.
But one company is trying to shake up the dealership model now. They want to be able to sell cars directly to the consumer. That's being met with resistance from auto dealers. What's this going to mean for potential car buyers? And from a business perspective, do car dealerships still make sense?
Joining us now is Brett Burke. He's a contributing writer to Popular Mechanics and has a recent piece titled, Do We Really Need Car Dealerships Anymore? It's linked on our Central Time Facebook page. Brett, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, to help us understand, tell us how the car dealership model first began.
Okay, well, it started out, you know, early on, car makers could sell directly to consumers, but when production capacity increased, you know, with the assembly line process and all of that, they had this greater capability of sort of disseminating cars in a wider way than one at a time. And so they set up this model that allowed them to gain sort of greater geographic reach quickly and with minimal investment on their part by, you know, selling franchises to dealerships. So they could get a foothold in larger territory, you know, further away from where they were manufacturing their product more readily by having dealers sort of take on some of this financial risk. And so as time went on, states enacted some laws that were designed in part to sort of prevent corporate ownership of these dealerships. They wanted to keep away the opportunity for dealers to give special treatment to stores that they were running personally, that the corporations were running, versus, you know, individually owned dealers. So that's in a nutshell the source of the current model.
We'll get into a new challenge to those dealerships, but in a nutshell, fast forwarding to today, does it make sense? Does this franchise model still work?
It's a really good question, and I think it's a complicated one. And I think that, you know, from my perspective, it's hard to advocate 100% for one or the other. If we have a model where 100% of the time manufacturers are selling directly to consumers, we end up, you know, no one wants to live in a company town, so to speak, right? No one wants to make all their purchases from the company store if manufacturers are the only ones setting prices. On the flip side, if we have a model where it's solely, you know, these franchises that are granted to dealers and that are protected against anyone, you know, anyone sort of infringing on that, we have something of a retail protected retail monopoly on the part of the dealers. And so I think, you know, it's possible that there's room within the system for more than one model. It's just a question of how then that can be sort of accessed by people, how that can be looked at by the government in a way that makes sure that that practices are fair on both sides, and that, you know, a manufacturer-owned store isn't undercutting or underpricing a local concern. So there's all of those questions.
Well, from a consumer standpoint, would you say that there are benefits of a dealership model, and what would they be?
Sure, I think there's benefits to both sides, actually. From a dealership model, you know, one of the big benefits is that, and the dealers will tell you this themselves as well, is this idea of sort of a local connection. And you know, as much as we live in a global economy, quote unquote, we still live our lives as consumers, oftentimes very locally. It might not be entirely the case for everybody, but I live in New York City. There's plenty of things that I could access, you know, and have delivered online that I don't, you know, that I have those relationships with local merchants who know me, who know my needs, who can be flexible in ways that sometimes an online site cannot be. And I think that can be the case as well with dealerships who have an understanding of their local consumer base, what their wants and desires are, what their needs are, and things like that, and who can be connected to the community in a way that supports the community. And I think there's something to be said for the idea that, you know, of a local economies being fueled by local community-based organizations, local community-based retailers.
So now there's a challenge here from the Tesla company, an alternative energy type of car, and they're saying, hey, we want to sell right directly to the consumer. What's the reaction to this?
Well, there's a few things. You know, in some states there are outright bans on this occurring. In Texas, for example, that's not allowed, and that so they're stuck in Texas without access to that model of selling directly to consumers. In other states, there's some. You know, if you are a company that has never had independent dealerships, you know, it's impossible for Tesla, not having ever had any franchises out there, to compete with their franchises. They don't exist. So they're finding ways to sort of make their way into the marketplace in other states where there's less restrictive laws or where there's sort of more openness for interpretation in terms of the laws. And I think there's benefits. You know, there's benefits there to consumers and to manufacturers. There's been some, you know, looking at sort of the additional cost of the dealership, dealer franchises and that whole system. You know, it's founded on dealers keeping, you know, a large and varied selection of vehicles on their lots that people can sort of come and pick and choose from, which requires, you know, significant overhead for the dealer, significant carrying costs and things like that. So some of that, if it was a built to order situation, some of those costs might be eliminated. I think from the manufacturer's perspective as well, you know, that's one of the big things. That being an automotive writer, you know, manufacturers are very much in control of their product development, in control of trying to make the best product they can, in control of sort of their brand messaging and their marketing and their public relations. But they're not in control of their dealership experience to a large degree. They can place certain strictures on how they want the dealership to appear and what kinds of customer service practices they would prefer to have occur, but the dealership is an independently owned business, and that doesn't always match up. So your experience in purchasing even a luxury vehicle sometimes may not feel, and for anyone who's ever been to the dealership, you can maybe attest to that, may not feel like a luxurious experience.
In our last minute here, if Tesla wins, whatever exactly that looks like, and they're successful somehow in selling direct to consumers, are other automakers looking at this and thinking, hey, maybe we can do without the franchise model?
I think that it's definitely possible that other people are sort of waiting, other manufacturers are waiting to see how this is going to play out and see how they could get in on the action. I think, you know, there's definite interest from both sides. It's just the question of sort of then what does that model look like? Where do people go to do their test drives? Where do people go to have their servicing done? Is that a manufacturer-owned store? Is that a local independent dealership? How does all of that play out? So I think there's a lot of questions that remain to be answered. I think, you know, it's like everything Tesla does, it's exciting and interesting and different. So I think there's something to be very much there to be supported in terms of the way that they've approached this.
Briefly, are they going to win, or are they going to be shut down by the current Dealers Association?
I have no way of predicting that. I think that they're having some successes right now. When I talk to the folks from Tesla, they talk about having a dealer franchise organization at some point in the future when they're larger. Right now, they're a very small scale manufacturer. So I think, you know, it's not a question of necessarily defeating this whole franchise operation and closing it down and making it a total, you know, manufacturer-led initiative. I think there's, you know, like I said earlier, it's probable that there's room in the system for both of these things to coexist. Just a question of how figuring that out.
Brett, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Brett Burke. His piece, Do We Really Need Car Dealerships Anymore, is in Popular Mechanics, linked to on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk to a guest who says it's hard to find courage in an age of anxiety, but our bravery is there and we need to use it.
That's tomorrow on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time with some Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels there. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. When you think of Detroit, the first thing that might come to mind is car manufacturing, the big three, maybe even the economic struggles facing the city today.
Well, our next guest reminds us that Detroit was once the epicenter of a thriving rock and roll scene, not just Motown, but rock. And in many ways, Detroit's music and manufacturing spheres were linked together and maybe dependent on each other.
In his new book, journalist Steve Miller compiles oral histories from the musicians, promoters, and scenesters who found themselves at the heart of the rock and roll city in its heyday.
Steve Miller's new book is Detroit Rock City, The Uncensored History of Rock and Roll in America's Loudest City. He joins us to talk about it. Steve, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
So before we get into some of the particular artists you talk about in your book, you say Detroit, in a lot of ways, was the number one rock and roll city in the country, not New York, L.A., or the other places we might think of. Make the case for it.
Well, I think Detroit, moreover, is the most influential rock and roll city in the world. I mean, I don't think you can take those the first three albums done by Iggy and the Stooges, and I don't think you can place them in any place other than the most influential albums. You can hear that sound in just about everybody's music, any good rock and roll band's music. You're just playing Mitch Ryder. I mean, that sound influenced legions of fans and wannabe musicians over the years. And then we got the MC5. And I say, you say it was the most influential. It still is, actually. I mean, there's a lot of cultural currency in Detroit, bankruptcy aside.
And you in Michigan, and I'm from Michigan originally, actually, and we here in Wisconsin kind of maybe have a similar phenomenon, the sense from the coast that we're flyover country, that you hear about what's going on in New York, what's going on in L.A., And I see in your writing and you're talking to musicians in your book that sense that if we were in New York, the local journalists would be checking out our shows and writing about us. Same with L.A. Do you feel like they felt slighted over the years by that coastal bias?
Yeah, I think people did. I mean, you'd have these bands playing, and you still do. I mean, I think the first time the scene ever really got the appropriate attention was with the so-called garage explosion in the late 90s. In the 60s, you had this amazing scene going on in Detroit, and everybody wanted to play there. And that went on right through the 70s. Everybody wanted to play there because you had great radio. You had three, four great radio stations. Then you had these terrific venues like the Grandy Ballroom and then later the Michigan Palace. And places like this in Olympia, and man, I'll tell you what, if you could turn some heads in Detroit, you could turn heads anywhere. It was a matter of making it work in Detroit that meant you were going to be accepted.
And one other analog between Michigan and Wisconsin, in both states, the statement is true. You've got your big city, biggest city in the state in the southeast, and then you go west on 94, and you're in the big college town. Was there that kind of ferment between the college scene in Ann Arbor and the big city scene in Detroit?
Well, it was the place that bands like you'd drive up to play in Detroit. You'd drive up the highway a little bit to play in Detroit, and then you could go back and you could have a little less threatening. You weren't sure that it wasn't a guaranteed thing that your van was going to get busted into, as it was in Ann Arbor, as it was in Detroit. So you had more space too. I mean, these bands, a lot of bands over the years have moved to Ann Arbor just because they could have nice space to work out in, to play in, and good practice rooms and that kind of stuff. And that went on for a while. I mean, the Stooges, of course, were from Ann Arbor. Bands like SRC, MC5, they moved down there because Seeger, of course, grew up in Ann Arbor. So there was a kinship there, of course.
We opened up
Madison to Milwaukee. Yeah,
yeah. We opened up the show with Mitch Ryder. I think in your book, he seems like a grandfather of the scene, meaning that he came out 4 years before a lot of the other bands that you just mentioned came around. Was he this guiding influence for the local music there?
He was for some people. You know, Mitch Ryder is kind of a he's a tough guy to take. But in the book, it talks about how he and Nugent had some of the toughest stagehands. You know, if you messed with those guys, they had these stage crews that would just annihilate crazy drunk offenders. And so Mitch Ryder was looked up to in some quarters. But again, he was kind of a prickly character. And I noticed that just talking to him, he always, he wouldn't let up, he put his, he really let his mouth would get in the way of a lot of things. In the book, we talk about his last stab at international fame was a band called Detroit. And that came about, they had a guitar player named Steve Hunter. Out of Illinois, and terrific. They had all the chances in the world to make it. And in this book, we focus on kind of Mitch Ryder's last stand, in the early 70s. But yeah, he was a big deal in Detroit, no matter what.
You mentioned those rough stagehands for Mitch Ryder and Ted Nugent, who we'll get to in a minute. But another theme that keeps coming back in your book is, man, you had to nerve up before you went to some of these shows. It got pretty wild, it sounds like.
Oh yeah, man. I mean, these were tough crowds. I mean, these were people who were just, you'd get off work at the shop, right? And then you'd go and your night was spent, on a checking out a 3-band bill. Of course, that's still the case as well. But yeah, at that time you had, these some of these venues were, they were heavy on the drugs and just it was a heavy party scene, and the bands were really, really delivering, and it was a heavy duty. I always like to call it like stamping plant rock. It was the sound of a big fender getting stamped, out of that stage.
Well, I pulled some more clips here, and I want to hear some of them. Let's check out, and I'm going to jump around, I think, a little bit on the chronology in the late 60s here, but the Amboy Dukes, featuring a guitarist who went on to be pretty famous. Let's give a quick listen. Come along if you can. So that's Journey to the Center of the Mind, the Amboy Dukes, featuring guitarist Ted Nugent, who is still pretty big in Michigan nowadays, I think.
Oh yeah, he's big everywhere. I mean, he's also big in his own mind. But the funny thing about that song, the bass player on that song, back when this was done in the late '60s, the draft was still on. The bass player's name was Bill White, and a lot of people were trying to get out of the draft. Bill White was one guy who said, "I'm not going to fight the draft. I'm going to go." And he told me this story, and it's in the book about how he landed. He came into Vietnam, into the encampment on a chopper, and they'd have the radio stations blaring through the speakers, these crude speakers all around the base, and that was one of the songs he heard, one of the first things he heard when he landed.
His own song.
Yeah, his own song, and I thought, wow, that's some kind of memory,
And now Journey to the Center of the Mind sounds kind of psychedelic, and there was a big psychedelic thing going on at the time. And you write about the arrival of LSD on the music scene in the area. How did that affect the music and the musicians?
Well, it was incredibly influential. I mean, it opened their minds up a little bit, and I think, everybody, drugs are going to have a different effect on everyone's creativity. A little bit is okay, but nobody ever does a little bit. But I think there are people that really, it broadened their minds, and there's some funny stories in there about people dosing and going and playing a show where they, forget where they were in the song. And they can make it sound really, really funny, and of course, it's an oral history, so I'm just the conduit, man. They're telling me these stories. I'm laughing as much as anybody else that's reading the book.
But I get a sense of tragedy in some of them too. I think somebody talked about amazing that Ted Nugent was one of the few people who emerged from that unscathed by the drug scene.
Ted was known as an abstainer from all substances. He simply was not interested in that. He makes that clear anytime you talk to him. I've interviewed him a few times over the years, but for this book, he made that very, very clear. And he talked about how he'd have to go around and he'd jam with people at various houses back then. They'd get together and play, and he said it was frustrating because he'd go to these houses and everybody'd want to get stoned first, and they'd run out of steam. And Ted doesn't seem to ever run out of steam.
Well, another act you mentioned, and let's give a listen now, one of my favorite tracks by Iggy Pop, or I think it may have been just the Stooges at the time. I'm drumming along, by the way, for those of you watching at home. So Iggy Pop and the Stooges, actually, the chronology kind of blew me away there, because I think of that as like, oh, that's, you know, punk mid-70s scene. 1969, is that right?
69, first album came out. You know, they started about in 68, the album came out, and they came out with two more. But they were right at the front, man. They were you know, way back. You know, Iggy was a drummer originally, and then he was influenced by a guy named Scott Richardson from the SRC to become a singer, and it all just came together. These guys were accidental heroes, and again, I still say, you know, they did these three albums. Again, what I cite is the three of the most influential albums of all time, and then those albums didn't do anything. They went to cutout. So for like 3-4 years, people were buying these albums for 99 cents. You couldn't give these things away. Then Britain discovered them, and that wave of punk that came out of Britain at that time was, you know. And then the albums, of course, became very valuable. But again, so it was kind of a wealth of riches for Iggy after the Stooges' greatness was discovered.
Accidental heroes, I think you said. Was there a sense from a lot of the people in talking to them, and you talked to a lot, I mean, the famous ones, the less famous ones, people who ran clubs, was there a sense among people that, hey, we are on the verge of making it big, or were they just local musicians who happened to catch on elsewhere?
Local musicians. A lot of these guys were lamenting the fact that, you know, why is nobody paying attention to Detroit? I don't even know if they wanted, you know, money as much as they wanted some recognition. And for the Stooges didn't have the discipline, as much discipline as all the other bands did, and they didn't have some sort of career plan, you know, now we'll go to New York and play and we'll do a showcase and that kind of thing. They just kind of bumped along playing this incredibly great music. But yeah, there was the feeling all over the place that, you know, how come we're not getting recognized? You know, one of the bands that did emerge from that kind of scene, I mean, thinking they played their first show in 69 was Grand Funk Railroad, who managed to succeed despite, you know, really having that link to Michigan, to lesser known areas.
And just before we go to a break here, Iggy Pop, I gather, invented the stage dive?
Yeah. Well, that's what somebody maintains in the book. And I said, you know, that's not a terrible assumption. You know, I don't see that, you know, we probably could have a healthy debate on that.
All right. Well, we are talking to Steve Miller about his new book, Detroit Rock City, The Uncensored History of Rock and Roll in America's Loudest City.
We'll have more with Steve Miller coming up. Then after 4 o'clock, we'll talk about the possibility of lighter prison sentences for low-level, nonviolent drug offenders. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Every season brings different challenges to keeping our pets healthy. Tomorrow at 11 o'clock, Judith Sears Poisson learns about the dangers of blue-green algae for our dogs and other late summer concerns. That's tomorrow at 11 o'clock on the Ideas Network.
Right now is a few headlines with Michael Leland from WPR News.
The former head of Boston's Irish mob, the Winter Hill Gang, has been convicted in a string of 11 killings and other underworld crimes. 83-year-old Whitey Bulger faces life in prison after being convicted of committing or playing a role in the killings during the 1970s and 80s. A suicide bomber has killed 13 people in a cafe in a town in central Iraq. It's the latest attack in a surge of violence that's continued for months. Meanwhile, Al-Qaeda's branch in Iraq is claiming responsibility for attacks that killed 69 people during the Muslim holiday that followed the end of the holy month of Ramadan. Military vehicle maker Oshkosh Corp has laid off at least 950 people in two phases this year. It's the result of a 30% decline in demand for the military vehicles that Oshkosh Corp produces. Since the number of layoffs exceeded 1% of the city of Oshkosh's total workforce, the region qualified for economic assistance from the U.S. Department of Defense. More news in 15 minutes.
Thanks, Michael. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster.
We're talking to journalist Steve Miller. He's got a new book out. It's Detroit Rock City, The Uncensored History of Rock and Roll in America's Loudest City. You could join in if you have a question, by the way, at 800-642-1234, or a memory about one of the bands we're talking about, 800-642-1234. Part of a kind of an informal series we're doing. We heard about garage bands in Milwaukee. We heard about Sub Pop in Seattle. We're hitting our neighbors over in Michigan and talking about the Detroit scene. Let's give another listen to one of the early influential bands, Steve, that you talk about, the MC5. Motor City is Burning. Not one of their more iconic songs, maybe, but those have F-bombs in them, some of them, so I couldn't pick those. First of all, talk about the MC5 and their influence.
Oh, another tremendous band on par with the Stooges. These guys just, you know, from downriver in Detroit and, you know, friends, and they all got together and they said, you know, initially it was, hey, we just want to play some rock and roll. And then they got to, they were in contact with a guy named John Sinclair who had revolution in his head, you know, and he thought that rock and roll was the vehicle to bring about this revolution. And the MC5 went for it, and their sound became incredibly fierce. Their guitars were, it was a two-guitar attack, Wayne Kramer and Sonic Smith. These are two of the great guitar players of all time. This is a band, everybody in that band was really, really strong. And they made three great studio albums and now left behind a whole host of things. And I talked to Wayne in the book and Dennis Thompson, the drummer. They tell such a great story, just all kinds of, you know, they were arrested all the time, busted all the time. And they had such a hard road to hoe. You know, and in the end, Dennis Thompson says, well, we should have been Grand Funk Railroad, which I thought was really, I've never heard him say that, so it's in the book. I thought that was really interesting.
Well, that song was The Motor City Was Burning, and around this time, there were riots around the country, including major riots in Detroit in 68, I think. How much did what was going on there in Detroit politically with these riots affect the bands you're talking about in that era?
Well, I mean, it was part of, I guess, the overall aura of revolution. The 67 riots were marking point for the city of Detroit, of course, and people always point to them as a turning point for the city. But in terms of the music, I can't say that it really affected the music. We just definitely discussed what everybody was doing during the riots in the book. In fact, I thought that was really interesting. I was captivated by that when I was talking to these people. But I think the music plowed ahead. I mean, I don't know how influenced it was by the riots, but it certainly turned the whole city on its ear.
And you get a sense from the people you talk to that people saw the MC5 declining along with Detroit, that it was like a barometer of sorts. Talk about that.
Yeah, it was funny how that worked, you know, and it's true. The demise of the band coincided with the demise actually of the whole scene at that time. I mean, you had this huge, the book is divided into three acts. And so the act one is just about how that huge swelling of these crazy sounds came out. As the band started, they all started doing more serious drugs like heroin, and it was just, you know, it took apart the MC5, and that part of the scene, you know, Stooges broke up, Five broke up, Mitch Ryder's Detroit wasn't going to make it, you know, and everybody kind of went, you know, it kind of fell into a lull. Seeger and Nugent would emerge then a little bit further down the line. Radio had started to go south a little bit, more corporate and not as adventurous.
Let's talk about Bob Seger, moving out of Chapter One a little bit now. Listen from the Live Bullet album that I did listen to a lot as a kid growing up in the area. So Bob Seger was kind of that next wave you just meant, or part of the next wave you just mentioned. How did he come onto the Detroit scene?
Well, he was out of Ann Arbor, and he had been hacking at it for so long. He'd been trying so long to make it, and he'd done some really, really good albums. But the commercial success began, as it's chronicled in the book, when he got the Silver Bullet Band together. And in the book, I talked to everybody in the Silver Bullet Band, and they really told me things I'd never really known about how that all came about. But the fame thing, it kind of covers the whole fame thing, where they started out as just this really tight band, and all of a sudden, next thing you knew, they were playing, you know, 300 nights a year, and just they were going platinum. They didn't. Nobody expected it. This is about the same time Nugent was starting to break out into FM radio. Remember, you know, corporate rock, you know, FM radio started liking, you know, Seeger, like Nugent. Those became the Detroit exports to the rest of the country.
And Bob Seeger had played, I didn't know this, I found out in your book, with Glenn Frey, later of the Eagles.
That's right. That's right. They were pals. I mean, in Ann Arbor, they were all pals. Frey was hanging out with, you know, he knew the Stooges. He knew everybody. The Five.
All right, now let's super fast forward to the 90s and chapter 3 of your book. We've got the White Stripes queued up. And earlier in the show, you mentioned the garage scene of the 90s being something that took off in Detroit. What was that scene? What was it like?
Well, what it was like was a whole bunch of really, really great bands that somehow the media had to put a term on it. So they called it garage. And as somebody in there said, you would have thought that everybody there was listening to Back from the Grave comps and sporting Prince Valiant haircuts. But it just wasn't the way it was. You had this very varied scene of great bands like Cloned Effects playing all variations of rock and roll. And yes, some of them did lean heavily on the older sounds. But any night you could go to places like the Gold Dollar and later on the Stick, the Magic Stick, I'm sorry, and you'd see these bands, they'd be played, half-filled places, seeing the White Stripes and so on. And of course, into bands like the Go, who were just terrific, made just great music and just never really, unfortunately, never went anywhere with it. But that was fine. It was good music in its own right. Bands like the Witches and Outrageous Cherry. But of course, again, the White Stripes emerged from that into catapulted into unbelievable fame, probably bigger than anybody ever thought would be.
And did they have to leave Detroit to make it big, or were they pretty big before they left?
Well, the thing about getting big or getting recognized is the courage to take your sound. You believe so much in your sound, and you could see this as I talked to Jack. It seemed to me it kind of this idea emerged. You could take your sound elsewhere, and you just wanted to try it out in front of different audiences. So you'd just be going out and you'd play, and you'd have singles for sale at the merch table and T-shirts, and you were just trying it out and hoping people dug the gospel you were singing, and I think that's what any good band does. It takes it away from, no longer do you want to be around just your friends telling you how great you are. You want to get out there and see, what an unbiased crew will tell you. They became big, of course, in Detroit, but they were just like anybody else for quite a while. Half-filled places, no big deal.
Now, right at the outset of this interview, you challenged my use of the past tense in describing a thriving music scene. What do you think of the scene now? What's coming out of it next? What should we watch for?
Well, I think at this point, they still do. Detroit still does rock and roll, I think, better than just about any city in the country. I say this: on any given night, you can go see a 3-band bill in Detroit at a little joint in Detroit. And out of those 3 bands, at least one of them will probably have you thinking later on, man, that was pretty good. And that's a pretty good ratio, pretty good crap factor, Because how many times you go out and you go to a place and there's 3 bands on the bill and you walk away going, but they were okay. But Detroit still has that. It still wields a mean guitar,
You drop a couple names that might be the big bands of the next few years?
I'm gonna always stand behind Human Eyes, my favorite right now going in Detroit.
Human Eyes, 2 words?
Human Eye, yeah.
Okay. And how do you describe them? describe them?
Space rock with a huge guitar.
Gotcha. All right. Well, Steve, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
That's journalist Steve Miller. He is editor of Touch and Go, the complete hardcore punk zine, 79 to 83. We've been talking about his new book, Detroit Rock City, The Uncensored History of Rock and Roll in America's Loudest City. Why don't we go out with a little, that White Stripes, we only got a little taste of that, if you could start fading that up, Michelle. What do we got coming up, Cynthia?
Well, coming up, the Obama administration wants to ease overcrowding at federal prisons by lightening up on prison sentences for low-level, nonviolent drug offenders. So we'll find out more about that after the news. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.